Hey everyone, before we get started, I just want to mention that The Ringer now has merch. Go to bit.ly.com/ringermerch, where you can find shirts and hoodies. A portion of the proceeds from each purchase will benefit Charity Water, a nonprofit organization that provides clean and safe drinking water to people in developing nations. Again, go now to bit.ly.com, that's bit.ly.com/ringermerch. Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB Show. I am Ben Lindberg, and I'm a staff writer for TheRinger.com. Just going to get right into it today because we have a couple longish interviews lined up. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Cole Figueroa, who started the season with the Pittsburgh Pirates, has since bounced around to a couple of organizations, and we've been talking for the last few episodes about the trade deadline and players going to and fro and what it means for the teams that acquired them. Cole is kind of a casualty of the trade deadline. There was a move that was made that bumped him off of a 40-man roster. He's been something of a journeyman this season, and so he's going to give us the kind of behind-the-scenes look at what happens when you are on the fringes of the big leagues and you're the 25th man on that roster, and when someone makes a move, you're the one who's got to go. But before that, I am welcoming in someone you know if you've watched any sports on TV for the last two decades or so. He's a host for MLB Network, he's a contributing writer at Sports on Earth, and he's the author of a new book, Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution. Brian Kenny. Brian, hello.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
All right. It's a pleasure to be the one hosting for once when I'm talking to you.
I know. It's turning the tables. Right. It's different. All the pressure's on you. You got to do the work.
Yeah.
To talk.
Yeah. So at the end of your book, you tell this story about, you know, you're in the ESPN newsroom and all of these ESPN employees are flocking to you to consult the Oracle, Brian Kenny, on their fantasy teams. And one of your colleagues sitting next to you would ask, how did you become the math guy? And as an English major, that's something I often wonder about myself. So for those who haven't read the book yet or followed your entire career from start to finish, how did you get to the point where you're writing a book about sabermetrics?
Yeah, that was Michael Kim, who I think is a math guy. And he was tired and both his parents are professors. And he was like, you know, people coming to you, this is too much. I guess I think that points to that and to your background, too, that it's really what, you know, what the metrics are is it's not or sabermetrics or it's not really it's not the math. It's not the numbers. It's the logical thought process. And that's really what appealed to me. My background, I guess, was, you know, hardcore baseball fan as a kid, like everybody, you know, nothing. You know, all of us, I mean, all my friends, we were really into baseball. Everybody was really into baseball. So it was nothing out of the ordinary. I think I liked baseball history a little bit more, which I get into in the book that, you know, I loved history to begin with. And then I loved baseball. So the two things put together and going to Yankee Stadium really appealed to me. So that love of baseball history led me to, you know, Hall of Fame. Going to the Hall of Fame as a child, my father taking me up there. And then I think that leads naturally to comparative analysis. You know, just like, how great was Lou Gehrig? You know, wait a second, Stan Musial, you know, how good was he? All right, Hank Aaron versus Willie Mays. You know, just we always make these comparisons. And so that led me, I really became like a Hall of Fame aficionado through my years. And when I became a young sportscaster, because I didn't think I'd be a sportscaster, I really aimed at being a news reporter. And just through the natural way that the TV news business is, you know, I thought I could, you know, make something better of myself by getting on the anchor desk, become a sportscaster. And that's when I just started doing baseball all the time. And then when you're doing baseball all the time, you're using numbers to compare, no matter who you are. Even if you hate numbers, you hate metrics, and you hate sabermetrics, all sportscasters are using numbers while they're doing their highlights, arguments, anything. And so that's what I was doing. And then it just led to obviously what was unfolding in the 80s and 90s, and that was, you know, sabermetrics, logical thinking, you know, Bill James, total baseball, and that, strangely enough, as I went through the years, was just being ignored by most people in my position.
And so you were into this stuff early on, total baseball and Bill James. Did it dominate your thinking to the extent that it does now? Did you just think, oh, this is interesting? Or did it immediately become the entire framework for how you viewed the game? Because you weren't so much a sort of a sabermetric spokesman at the time, but maybe that was just about the job as much as about you.
No, I think it all came about, right? It unfolded in a certain way, but I was not this sabermetric zealot.
Yeah.
as I've become through the years. And only because, you know, why? I was just talking about Ron Santo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I was doing this show on WTZA called Sports Line Live. So I had a half hour talk show after our local newscast in the Hudson Valley. I did my, you know, high school sports. I went out and shot high school sports, college sports. And then we had a talk show. So I had a thing called Hall of Fame Night because I just always was doing on my own. You know, I guess this is kind of geeky, but I always had like little charts and books kept on players and Hall of Famers, just like when I was a kid. But now I could say, hey, Ron Santo, what about him? Oh, Ken Boyer, where is he in the Hall of Fame discussion? Thurman Munson, you know, like whoever. I just doing my comparisons, but I was doing comparisons like everybody else, you know, looking at total home runs, RBIs, but trying to do it the best I could. When I started reading Total Baseball, I started to get some other tools, but it happened slowly. You know, I could see, you know, total player ranking. I could see Pro Plus, which was the precursor to OPS Plus. And so I started seeing these other numbers, started to incorporate them, but it was slowly. I wasn't suddenly shouting from the rooftops. It was like, here's another way of looking at it. And of course, that would increase through the years, eventually leading me to Baseball Tonight, where I'm doing it all the time. And at that point, I'm thinking, you know, the internet is starting up and I'm thinking, wait a second, you know, what are we looking at here? And why are we still talking this old language?
And as my colleague Brian Curtis noted when he wrote a profile about you earlier this year, you kind of, you know, wandered in the wilderness for a little while. You didn't break through immediately. You had kind of paid your dues in local stations before you got to a national network. And was there a moment where you changed, or did the network change in a way that suited you, or was it just a matter of getting the right break?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a whole other story. I mean, I was a newscaster, you know, a news reporter, then became, on Long Island, WLIG, and then had a chance to get on the anchor desk. And I guess I should explain that a little bit. Like, you know, I'm a 22-year-old, you know, news reporter, and I'm really bad. I mean, my performance is not good. I'm stiff.
Uh-huh.
I'm like junior newsman. I look terrible and in a bad suit and a bad mustache, the whole thing. And when there was an opening for the sportscaster's position, a lot of us, you know, the reporters thought, hey, we should audition for that. And the reason is you get a chance to go on the anchor desk. You know, it's like a promotion. So I had this background in sports, but I truly did not want to be like the next Marv Albert, which is what everybody else, you know, on Long Island seemingly wanted to be.
Uh-huh.
You know, everybody wanted to be the next Marv Albert. And I didn't want to do that. Everybody's working on their play-by-play. This was, you know, also the beginning of, you know, not sports talk radio hadn't hit yet, but there was, you know, some sports talk shows, you know, in its infancy, and ESPN had just gotten on the air. So there was this, you know, burgeoning industry. But for me, it just seemed like, you know, I don't have to go out and cover landfills today. I can go to a high school baseball game, or I can do a high school athlete of the week. It just seemed like the move, you know, to make. But I did that on Long Island, WLIG. I did that then at WTZA, and I was there 11 years. That's when I got married. My wife, Nicole, and I started having children. We have 5 children. And so when you're in that situation, you can't just bop around like everybody else and go to Albany, go to Hartford, like the normal career path.
Yeah.
So I was just in Kingston all those years. And, you know, my wife and I, we were happy in Kingston. And, you know, at some point, though, of course, I wanted to move up. I wanted to make money. And, you know, I was sending my tapes out, and mainly to ESPN. And then fortunately, you know, finally was able to break through, get an audition at ESPN, and get in there about a year after they started ESPN News.
And you weren't a big catchphrase creator, were you? I don't remember you being identified with any particular.
I was actually against that.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that I did later, and it was all organic, was when I was doing Baseball Tonight, I became known for a few of those because I actually used the phrases that I used in wiffle ball with my sons. I have 5 kids, and we play wiffle ball, and, you know, mostly my sons, like through those years. And, you know, when you hit a shot up into the tree, you know, you hit the second limb,
uh-huh,
and now it's a double, you know, you have to kind of announce, okay, what runs score, who gets in, where are the men on base, how many outs, because, you know, nobody's actually running. You know, you're just occupying the base because we're playing in the driveway. So I would say, you know, oh, that's a double. 1 run will score. 2 runs will score.
Right.
You know, and I would just do this fake baseball announcer guy. And so when I was doing Baseball Tonight, I started doing that because, you know, at the time, Baseball Tonight, it's not like it is now. We were doing 2 hours every single night.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of show. seemed like a lot of show at the time. And so I started doing a few of those. So I had a few things, but I was, I know there were write-ups of me actually in TV Guide and that sort of thing, that I was shtick-free, believe it or not, that I was, you know, I just kind of played it straight. I tried to speak intelligently, and I didn't do a lot of the, you know, the zany local sportscaster antics.
And my first really prolonged exposure to you, of course, I'd seen you on other shows before, but when you did the ESPN radio show with Max Kellerman, and I was stuck at a boring summer job at the time, and that was the thing that sort of got me through my morning. And of course, Max is now on First Take, and I think a Kellerman Kenny First Take would be a First Take I would actually watch, but we didn't get that. But did you have to think about that when you made the move to MLB Network in 2011? Were you thinking, you know, I'm sacrificing some national visibility here? There are people who are never going to know me now because they don't watch baseball. Or did you think, well, you know, the culture is getting more and more splintered all the time, and people are just watching the one thing that they want to watch instead of watching the national news anyway, so this is the better situation for me?
Yeah, that was definitely in the background, but in the foreground is your own, you know, personal situation. And my wife and I had gotten to the point where we were also in Bristol, Connecticut, and we're making a choice. And, you know, when your contract comes up, you're always making a choice. And we had gotten to the point where we were down to just one of the kids in the house, you know, the other kids going in college or getting out of college. And we just thought, well, you know, I could stay at the time, again, before, you know, now they've had layoffs and all these other things. But at the time, it was only 5 years ago, there really was a thought that, hey, you could spend your whole career at ESPN. You know, you just stay there. And that was really, that was only a few years ago, but that was definitely the thought. And it's like, if that's the case, that's not so bad. But it was just a confluence of things, a chance, you know, to do something new, to move down to New York. Also, you know, kids out of the house, again, five kids, you know, again, that's the dominant thing in my life. It's that, you know, wife and five kids. This is, you know, I don't just bounce around. These things you have to take seriously. And how does it affect everyone else in your family? And that coupled with, you know, it's baseball and it's the league network, and they started this network and it was pretty good. You know, it was, you know, right from the start, you could see, hey, they're having fun. They're doing a nice job. The sets are beautiful. It's well-funded. It's well-run. And they were really going after me. You know, they were charting me. They knew where I was. They knew me. The guys who were there at MLB Network, it was John Entsch and Tony Petitti. John Entsch was from ESPN. You know, he knew of me through other people. I didn't know him personally. And Tony Petitti, I'd actually interviewed before at various levels when he was at CBS. And so they were waiting for me. And when someone really wants you and gets after you and, you know, makes, you know, a competitive offer, and it's baseball 24/7, it's what I really love to do. That on top of everything you mentioned, made it like, hey, if I don't do this, you know, now, what am I thinking? Like, everything was so lined up perfectly. And I'd been at ESPN 14 years. You know, I've been there a long time, and it was time to get a new opportunity, and, you know, it's worked out beautifully.
Is a one sport specific network more resistant to the fear about, you know, people don't need us anymore? They don't need to tune in to watch the highlight show. They can watch it on Twitter. They can read the recap on whatever their favorite site is. Is there any concern about that with the shows that you host? Or is the feeling that these are hardcore baseball fans and this is a hardcore baseball channel, and so they're not going to forsake us?
Well, there's always like thought of what's around the bend. But I know how I digest baseball now. Like, I can obviously, you know, with the At Bat app, I can watch every game.
Right.
You can watch them all the time. But I know what I crave is, and how I like to digest baseball is, I want to watch part of the game. I want to see the best parts of the game. It is a little tougher these days to watch, for me anyway, to devote 3 hours to one game. Mm-hmm. I like to bop around and I like to get perspective. You know, I find when I get home now, and this is kind of the test, when I get home from work and I do MLB Now, after I have dinner, hang out with the family, I'll flip on the game and then I'll flip back over to MLB Tonight, because I not only want to see parts of the game, I want to know, okay, what does that mean? What should I be thinking? What's happening with this team? You know, so I want to hear the guys on the desk, you know, kind of give their perspective on things, you know, for a few minutes or a minute, and then boom, back to another game. So I think the product that we have is something pretty sustainable, that this is, you want to get an instant perspective, and then you want to bop around to the next game. And So whether that's done on cable or whether that's done on your phone, I think that, you know, I think that's something that will hold forth in the future.
And looking back at your early days at MLB Network, I mean, you know, you hosted Clubhouse Confidential at the time. And in retrospect, it's hard to believe that a show like that ever got on the air, I think, in the first place, you know, and that's no statement on the quality of the show. It's just the premise of the show is not something that you see on any other network, even now. And I'd imagine that that was a product of, you know, them really wanting you and you really wanting to do that show. And so it was, hey, come to our network and we'll let you do the show where you talk about advanced stats and you have a bunch of writers on who've never been on TV before and in many cases look like they've never been on TV before. And we'll just let you guys nerd out about stats for half an hour.
I know, and what a great show, right? I
yeah,
mean,
sure.
It really was, because it was just right to have you on, to have the guys, you know, to have Rob Nyer on, you know, to have Joe Sheehan on, Jonah Carey, and Jonah had just gone to Grantland at the time, so I made phone calls to him, and he had just left.
Right.
But then Dave Cameron, you know, just, you know, hey, who are the smart people out there? And I'd always done that at ESPN when I was on the hot list for a
yeah.
couple of years on ESPN News in the afternoon. It was a chance to, hey, we got 3 hours. Do you got any ideas? And so it was like, yeah. So yeah. Next thing you know, Rob Nyer is on. Skip Bayless was one of the first guys I started to have on too, just because I thought, hey, this guy's provocative. It's opinionated, and he backs it up. Let's do a phoner.
Uh-huh.
So I was always doing that. But you know how Clubhouse Confidential happened actually was because they were thinking at the time it was pretty much MLB Tonight, and that was it. They had just started Intentional Talk, you know, with Chris Rose and Kevin Millar. So, you know, again, it's a fledgling network. They're just thinking, all right, what do we want to do here? Instead of rolling out, I think they were very smart to do it this way. Instead of rolling out 10 new shows, they said, hey, we have a flagship. Let's build organically where it makes sense. And they had, again, Kevin Millar is there. He's like, you know, he's a zany figure and he's, you know, hilarious to watch. And he had a friendship with Chris Rose. So it was like, hey, why don't we have a different show that presents baseball? And there it is. That was the first different show. So I'm coming aboard. And I'd actually sent an email to them like before I got there saying, here are my ideas. This is what I think we should be doing. But I really meant it for MLB Tonight. Let's have side segments where we do performance analysis.
Uh-huh.
Let's have these guys that I read all the time. Let's have them on the show. Let's stop down with every trade and bring someone in. Hey, let's do a high heat segment or a digging in segment. Let's rank players. Let's compare players historically to players now. I had, you know, all these different things, and got a phone call one day from John Entsch, who said, hey, why don't we just let you do a show? I said, wow, oh, yes, I can do that. I believe I can hang out with you fellas now. And so that's where it came about. It was awesome. It was a real challenge because it's a lot of writing, even a half-hour show, but it was something I could really jump into. And actually, because of that exercise of writing every single night and of doing, you know, basically it's a column, it's a small column every day. That's where I gained the confidence and even the thought that I could write a book. Because up until then, like I realized I'm in television, I write, but I write for TV and it's very different. I didn't think I was an author. I didn't think I, you know, could just churn out a book. But my writing for Clubhouse Confidential and thinking of something, creating something, writing something every day, crunching it with our researchers, like all through the morning, you know, going back and forth on ideas, that eventually led to actually me thinking that I could write a book someday.
So now as the host of panel shows, and, you know, you're not just teeing people up, you're doing solo segments, you're doing interview segments, but is there any itch that these shows aren't scratching? Is there something that you wish that you had a platform to do that just doesn't really fit into the roundtable format?
I don't think so. I mean, I think eventually, you know, it'll probably morph into something and I'll want to do something. But right now I try not to take for granted that I'm doing precisely the show that I would want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I could look back even at ESPN, you know, I was doing SportsCenter and then I got a radio show and I was doing Friday Night Fights, but eventually SportsCenter morphed into like, look, I'm just I'm an anchor, you know, I'm just facilitating. And it's not something that you're tapping into your creativity. And it's not something that, you know, my brain is not at work. And at the time, even the thought was, yeah, but we need you to do SportsCenter and then go off and play on radio and say whatever you want. You know,
yeah.
And that was kind of the trade-off. It was okay. And then on the radio, now I can be opinionated and let it fly. And that was satisfying. This is like both. You know, and on top of it, I'm like, on top of me being able to branch off and, hey, I want to do opinion, or I want to do some comparative analysis, I want to geek out and, you know, compare Bryce Harper to the other great teenage hitters in baseball history, or should the Pirates trade Andrew McCutchen and just explore that, or who is the greatest first baseman of all time and just do that. I can do it anytime I want. And then I still get people to bounce things off of. You can have a lively conversation. And on top of that, I can also have that one guest, you know, that whether it's a sabermetrician, you know, whether it's you, whether it's bringing Dave Cameron in on a satellite, or whether it's having a comedian, having Jim Brewer sitting next to me, you know, or having George Will sit next to me. Those are among our guests. Mm-hmm. So you can have these guests. You know, to me, at the end of most of these shows, I'm like, wow, like, what show would I rather do? Like, on a lot of days, I've even said, like, we've had, you know, I don't want to just name certain names, but there are certain times where we've had, like, the panel, like, if it's, say it's John Smoltz or Ron Darling, you know, and you and Ken Rosenthal or Joel Sherman or John Heyman, I would say, you know, if this was my old ESPN show and I had, like, you guys on back to back to back, that would be a great hour. Like, that would be a dream hour that I would say, oh, my God, look at this, one smart baseball guy, you know, with different perspectives after another. And I just got to have everybody at one time for a full hour. I don't want to take that for granted, that it's about the best show I could possibly conceive at this point.
So to what extent does the persona that you alluded to of the sabermetric zealot, to what extent does that represent the real you? I mean, I've been around you and it's not like you are a different person when the camera is off or anything. But, you know, I would imagine that to a certain extent you present a certain image because it works on TV. And so to what extent is that a kind of created persona? And, you know, are there times when you sort of regret what you've unleashed? Because, you know, as you were just saying to me before we started recording, you know, in every interview you get asked about stop bunting or kill the win and these kind of slogans that have become the Brian Kenny brand. And, you know, they're things that you believe, but you get boiled down to a soundbite and, you know, boil yourself down to a soundbite at times, too. So it must be kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And it's part of what plays on TV. But you know me. I mean, that's me. That's the real me. And part of, and a lot of this is born of a whole era, which is definitely lessening. But in a long era of there's the guy in the suit. That's me, right? That's my role. There's the guy in the suit, the professional traffic cop, the traditional anchor man. And now here's the expert, you know, a big dude in a suit. He played professional ball, whatever sport that is. Key him up, listen to him, thank him, and go to break. Mm-hmm. And that's the role. And it's again, you know, rinse and repeat again and again and again. And my natural inclination is to question, is to say, why is that? You know, or what are you thinking there? Or, and then when I gain more knowledge, like even if it's in football, it's like, yeah, but why were they still running the ball? You know, it can be as simple as that. Yeah, but the play calling was terrible in the late going. I was watching that game. Like, hold on. I was watching that game. That's not what happened. And so I would push back. And I realized when I did that, a lot of these guys, a lot of these ex-professional athletes, you know, really liked it. You know, some really didn't like it. But some real, like you could see the majority of these guys, their eyes light up when you actually engage them. And this is before the embrace debate revolution, right, at ESPN. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't going around arguing with people just for, hey, let me create this. But it was really was just what I was thinking. And at a lot of times, and still to this day, when I'm watching TV, other shows, I'll be saying, challenge that. You know, don't let them get, like, kind of stop, question that. Like, this happened just the other night where it was a bunt, believe it or not. It was a bunt. And it was in the Mets-Yankees game. And I'm watching it. I'm cracking myself up. I'm watching it, and I'm seeing guys that I know on TV, smart guys. And I'm just saying, hey, that bunt that, you know, in a crucial time, question that. Like, just don't take it for granted that, well, of course you bumped it. No, you don't have, you didn't have to. Just question and back it up. And you could, it's definitely defensible. It was actually, what was it? It was the Mets man on second against Dellin Betances. And my point only is, like, so they bunted a leadoff double. They bunted him to third base, one out. Then Betances gets a strikeout. Now you got two outs and, you know, he's one away. And so now you know, okay, now you know the cost of the bunt. And that's all I'm asking is, hey, question it. Just don't take it for granted, because, again, I grew up at a time just also watching TV where I would hear national announcers say, well, no one could question what he did right there. And I'm saying, no, I can question it. Anybody can, you should question it. So, like, you can see, like, my voice is getting raised now. Because I just, it's not even the questioning of it, but it's the ability to ask. The ability just to say, let's think this through. Just because that guy is the manager or the head coach, and this goes through with all authority figures, he's just another person. Yeah. Why do we think he must have been right? We can ask. Now, any human, everybody can make a mistake or play the odds the wrong way. But no, that's the natural me, that I have a nonsense detector. And even on a set now, when I'm working with guys that I really like, I'll hear them say something. They'll see me flash up and look at them, and they'll go, uh-oh. And I'll say, no, I'm just wondering. I want to ask. And it's not that I want to be so combative, but it's like, well, now if I'm sitting at home, and I really do think people might be saying, oh, come on, Brian Kenny, you're going to let that go? Like, and that's how I am. Like, when I'm watching another program, a sports program, I'm thinking, you're going to let that go? Ask that. Follow up. You know, be real. So that's just really part of my persona. And the other part of it where, pitcher wins, stop bunting. I'm hoping, like, I don't get asked that, because it's right. It is so simplistic, but I get into it in nuance in the book. So if someone's reading the book, it's like, no. I get into exactly why we treasure these dead ball ideals. Why, to this day, there's this small ball obsession. You know, it's traced to the roots of baseball. So that's one thing I think the book does, is I handle it in depth with nuance. I'm not screaming. It's not simplistic. It's not just bunting is stupid. It's just, hey, let's take a look at what's the risk reward? What are the pluses and minuses? This is where it comes from. And beyond that, it's like, okay, I'm not just screaming about it. Because on TV, you're having these small snippets. And, if that's the shtick that gets out there, it's still good, clean fun. You know, I don't find, at a certain point, I think after this book and after all of this, I don't bring it up as much. But, just last night, I see, watching a certain show, I saw pitcher wins come to the fore 3 times in one segment, a guy's record. And I still thought, no, I'm not screaming, going, what are they doing? But I was like, why would you even reference that? Like, why? Like, it's done in place of thinking. It's done because of habit. And so it does still hit me that, why would you still do that? Like, you're citing these stats. What are you thinking exactly? So I'm always on the set when I'm working, trying to, envisioning what a viewer would be thinking, and try to do it for their benefit. Be out there for them and actually, get into it, keep it real, and question things.
And I know you're not an absolutist about this stuff. And, someone tweeted at you yesterday and said, do you think nobody should ever bunt again? And you said, not at all. There are places to do it. And maybe that's just something that you don't have time to say on TV because you've got to go to break. But there's also this kind of interesting tension there because, someone else tweeted at you and said that he likes when you talk about small samples or small sample size. And you said that was quite a revelation back in the day, and now it's a cliche. And you acknowledge in the book that there has been so much progress. There's a line in the book where you say revolutionary thought is now mainstream thought. And, even as you talk about how people should bunt less, I'm sure you're aware that people are bunting less than ever before. So, there's this kind of interesting backlash from sort of the extreme ends of the spectrum. You've got the extreme old school people who I'm sure react to your book or your writing or whatever in the way that you would expect someone like that to react. But then on the far, far right, most advanced side of the spectrum, the people, at Baseball Prospectus or Fangraphs, you almost have this kind of diametrically opposed backlash where they say, oh, this stuff has already been embraced. We know this, and, it's almost simplifying it too much. So it's this weird kind of role where, on one hand, you're the only person actually putting people like me on TV to talk about the things that we write about, essentially. And yet there are people who are sort of rejecting your being a spokesman for the movement in a sense, or making the claim that you're, exaggerating the extent to which these things are not embraced.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a bunch of things in all of that. One, I remember when I was first writing Clubhouse Confidential and we were starting the show, and I was being interviewed, by different websites for it. And I really thought at the time, as I was writing it out, I was like, wow, how is the hardcore community going to view this?
Uh-huh.
because I really had a thought that they're going to hate this. Like, they're just not, they're going to hate it, because I had to stop down. Again, this is only 5 years ago, but you have, I mean, if I could take you back 5 years, you know, I had to stop down and explain everything. I explained OPS. Again, you know, this is 5 years ago. You know, I had coordinating producers at Major League Baseball Network, these guys who work full-time in the baseball industry, tell me, hey, you have to explain this. And I would say, I don't have to explain that anymore. And they're like, I don't know what it is. I'm like, oh, wow,
yeah.
Really? Okay. And so, yeah, let's not be arrogant about it. Because if a guy working full-time in the baseball industry, and by the way, ex-players, how about players who've played 15 years in the majors are saying, I don't know what that is. So if you're thinking, oh, but if you read the websites, this was so 2002. Oh, well, guess what? It's still, it was 2011, and it's still to this day in 2016, where, huh, this is still a revelation to a majority of baseball fans. So when I was writing Clubhouse, I really thought the hardcores are not going to like this. And it turns out the hardcores did like it, I think because I did it in a slow fashion for them, but I still explained why. And it was just me, and I wasn't screaming at a sports writer, right? It was much more of a low-key organic show, a little more of an intellectual show. Now I do hear occasionally, right, on Twitter especially, that people say, oh, will you stop with that? And I've heard that, like, from Joe Sheehan, oh, please get another, torch, you know, do something, you know, like, find another thing for your bully pulpit. And I'm like, you know, I get it, but you don't, I have to say to him and to anybody else out there, you don't live in my world. You have to live in my world where I'm surrounded by ex-players. I'm surrounded by sports writers who are still making the transition. And so even when I bring up, like, you know, I know, yeah, it can be a caricature of, oh, no, a bunt, but we're just having fun on the set. And I'm just saying, as I said last night on MLB Tonight, hey, can we just question it? Like, I just want to ask about it. And I was asking Harold Reynolds, oddly enough. I was on the set with Harold. I was like, hey, it's first and second. Nobody out. But they're bunting. Do you like that? Well, let's talk about it. And you can like it. You can dislike it. But at least question it instead of, well, of course you got a bunt here. Well, no, that's the last 30 years. And the other thing is, for those who also get on me like, hey, this is so, you know, old. It's 2002. It's like, and why are you yelling? I would say you didn't live through that time. Like, this really is a generational thing. And I realized, look, my researcher on the book was my son, Peter. Pete was on my radio show. Pete, you know, has an economics background at Berkeley, and he keeps me honest on this stuff. And he too tires of that. And I say, Pete, you didn't live through it. You didn't, you know, now he sort of did, you know, through me, because he saw me battling these guys, you know, for the last 20 years. But if I can understand, if someone is 24 years old now, 25, and they're coming up saying, wait a second, you know, this stuff has been widely accepted. Look at the baseball ops departments, and look at the way things are written about on the internet. And look at, and no, what's the struggle? Yeah, well, you missed the struggle. You missed it when sabermetricians like yourself, now that you're 24, 25, whoever you are out there, at, you know, not that long ago, you would have been ostracized, you would have been marginalized, you would have been humiliated, and you wouldn't be able to work in the industry. How does that feel?
Yeah.
Like, how does that feel? And I remember a conversation I had with you, Ben, a few years ago with Sam Miller,
uh-huh,
right, on your podcast.
Uh-huh.
And you were, and I don't know if it was you or Sam said, hey, what, you know, what about the yelling? And you seem to, like, be in attack mode.
Right.
And I remember saying to you guys, hey, these guys have your jobs, by the way. Like, these writers that I attack, they've got your jobs. Now it's starting to change, isn't it? Look, now you're moving up. Now you went from Grantland to The Ringer, and you're kind of mainstream. And Jonah actually got on Baseball Tonight.
Right.
I was trying to get Rob Neyer on Baseball Tonight 17 years ago. Couldn't do it. So I'm saying, hey, if you guys aren't outraged, well, you should be. And maybe not screaming about it. And if you want to say, well, eventually this will take care of itself. Yeah, you might be 55. Like, why wouldn't you have these jobs when you're 24 or 25? So I understand why the new generation coming up would say, you're so strident. And I would say, you missed the struggle. You know, and you're welcome. You know, because you wouldn't have gotten through if it hadn't been for, one, the pioneers that I speak about in the book extensively, the guys who were marginalized and embarrassed, and the guys then who also got jobs for these teams in the 80s and 90s, and most all of them were run out of town on a rail. And those guys fought a very different struggle. Now, you're welcome. There's very little struggle, but it's also an economics issue where you're only now, you, Ben, and your ilk are only now breaking through where you're getting the jobs. But even 5 years ago, that was not the case.
Yeah, and I saw that at my time at Baseball Prospectus. By the time I started there, really the first generation had moved on, and it was, you know, people like Joe Sheehan and Christina Carl and Keith Law and all these people who went on to jobs at ESPN or Sports Illustrated or wherever it was, and they had kind of popularized this snarky oppositional tone in the early days of BP because it was easy to take that tack back then because there was a lot to criticize. And by the time I came along, you know, a lot of those people were working for baseball teams, and, you know, baseball teams were operating in line with the principles that those early BP people had espoused. So it was much easier for people of my generation to take this kindlier consensus building tone because there just wasn't as much to object to.
Yeah, and it's still there, by the way, like a lot of people that are beefing with it. It's, you know, and I see them out there, and they're on Twitter, and I see the criticism, and it's like, okay, but, like, where are you now? Like, what jobs do you have? And are you understanding of the invisible walls? And are you understanding where you are there? And that it still exists because the people in the hiring process, the people in the positions of power, still have you marginalized and still aren't embracing this. And it's only very, very recently that Major League Baseball itself and these teams have brought their ilk in. It wasn't long ago that those guys would be, and I mean literally, because I saw it, laughed at. Mm-hmm. Literally laughed at. And the names I would bring up, even when I was in the middle of this mainstream media, and this is not only a few years ago, and this is all through, you bring up Keith Law. You know how many times I had to say, why don't we bring in Keith Law?
Yeah.
Why can't we get Keith Law on our show? Why can't we get, well, we want this guy. No, but I want Keith Law. Yeah, but why can't I get Buck Showalter? Why can't I get, like, I wanted thinkers. Again, it wasn't just sabermetricians or, you know, Nate Silver. It was, hey, Buck Showalter is there. But we want this guy, this ex-player who's very jocular. And that continues. I mean, look at what's out there now. I thought at the time when I first got to MLB Network, you know, I wanted to get, like sign up a bunch of sabermetric writers right away. And I thought, hey, and I told this to our executives. I go, these guys are going to be locked up, like it's happening. Like other networks that are going to be starting, ESPN, once they start seeing the shows we're doing, they're going to start doing these shows. And it's going to take over. I thought it would be a matter of just a couple of years. Now, it hasn't happened, which is good and bad, right? I still can say, I do the smartest show on sports TV. Well, there's not a lot of competition. You know, once Keith Olbermann left the air, it was like, okay, who else is even trying to do a smart show? You know, they actually had a show on ESPN, which was based on my premise of Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I ever had you in to do that. And it was this premise of you take an insider, right? And it could be, I think we had Nomar Garciaparra, and then I think we had Joe Sheehan, let's say, on ESPN Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did it for football as well, where we'd have Herm Edwards and we'd have Aaron Schatz. And it was also, you know, bring in basically an analytics guy and then bring in a guy in the sports industrial complex, you know, ex-player, coach, whoever it is, and bring up the same premise, ask the question and have them answer it. And they would answer it very differently. And it was Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside. And it was, you know, an homage also to, you know, the Army backfield. Are you aware of Doc Blanchard, you know, Glenn Davis back in the 40s? That was the famous Mr. Inside, Mr. Outside. So as an homage for that, we had this like campy sort of lead up, like a 1940s shtick on ESPN Radio. They liked it so much that they started asking me to do it on SportsCenter. I did it a few times on SportsCenter. And then a couple of months later, a show emerges. I see a PR release that says, hey, we're going to do a show called Numbers Never Lie, where we have an insider answering the same questions as an outsider. I said, wait a second. Whoa, where did this come from?
Yeah.
And that was the show based on that idea. Now, that show didn't live because they didn't have people, I guess, that believed in it because they really didn't stick to it. But I thought there would be a proliferation of shows just like that because why not? And then once we start reaching a consensus, just do a smart show. And yet I watch football pregame, basketball pregame. Let me see. I don't watch a lot of hockey, but I don't think they're doing it, even though NHL Network is now housed with us.
Mm-hmm.
And with baseball, there's, I don't know, beyond what I'm doing. Is anybody else doing, like, here's a smart panel show to actually do some analytics? Is anybody doing that?
Well, I will say that while I was at ESPN and technically not allowed to go on your show, I think I still got more requests to go on your show than I did from any other ESPN show, which, you know, might have more to do with me than it had to do with ESPN. I don't know. Maybe it was a smart decision.
No, it doesn't. Again, no. That's their fault. That's their fault. Why would that be? And I would say, listen, I'll give you an example. There's a guy, Mark Simon. You know Mark Simon,
yep.
right?
Uh-huh.
He has a new book out. He's a researcher at ESPN.
Right.
It's a book out on the Yankees now. And I see Mark at various functions around. And Mark was a researcher that I used to have baseball little arguments and conversations because he was just working on the show. And at night after SportsCenter, I would go do my radio show for ESPN, and I would just say, hey, why don't you just drop by? You're working tonight. Why don't you just walk down?
Mm-hmm.
And so he walked down. We did a segment because he disagreed with me on something. And I thought, hey, this is a good disagreement where we're disagreeing in a wonky fashion. Like it's like degrees of wonk, you know, where, you know, clearly I get it that Derek Jeter is this and that. But what about this? And he was more hardcore than I was. And I was like, this is great. I found a guy more hardcore who can really defend himself, who can illustrate things that I can learn from. And so I brought Mark down. We did a segment. It was great. And we started to do more segments. And I wanted to put him on the air more. And there was resistance because it was like, well, who's this guy? And I'm like, who's this guy? He's our researcher. He's smart.
Right.
Like, why wouldn't you build? Like, you could build around Mark Simon and a whole bunch of guys within the walls at ESPN. It would be easy. They're all over the place, but they're not getting on TV. And on, you know, an NBA show, like, where's Zach Lowe? On an NFL show, where's Aaron Schatz? Like, where, and I don't even know, like, beyond that, is it Barnwell and other guys who are, you know, the leading thinkers? Now I've lost touch with that, the leading thinkers in football. But where are all these people, and how come they're not on TV? No, that should be done, but again, think to it. You think, oh, the revolution is over. Why don't you just play nice? It's like, okay, but it hasn't happened to that full extent yet. And that, by the way, affects your livelihood. And Ben, your livelihood.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, Zach used to go on the Grantland Basketball Hour. I think he goes on The Jump now. I know Bill goes on SportsCenter sometimes, and they each have an excellent podcast, so they get some exposure, and they deserve every bit of it.
Yeah, but where are they during the NBA Finals? We have network shows on the NBA Finals, and then there's network shows every weekend on the NFL. Where are those guys? They're not on the big shows. That's the trough,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the trough. That's the money machine. That's the cog of the mainstream media, and they're not there yet. Now, media is building around these walls, and so that maybe it's a flanking device where now, yeah, there's so much new media that they're doing that, but yet what is the real the country still to this day stops down and watches these huge events, and I would ask you, have you and the people like you broken through to that level?
I suppose not. I don't know
nope,
if the nation is suffering. But
no, but why not have smarter TV? Why not have smarter people? The only reason I've broken through is because I had a separate skill set of I'm an anchorman.
Right.
Like I could have not done any of this stuff or lent my expertise in baseball and my study of baseball. I could have just done, you know, hey, I'm an anchorman. I'm going to anchor shows and I'd be on my merry way. I don't know if I could have lived with that, you know, just being a hairdo, but I could have just done that. I have the skill set. I can be an anchor, throw to break. The only reason I'm through to talk sabermetrics on TV is because I had that other skill set that, you know, that the industry liked.
Yeah.
And so I happened to bring this other package with me. But otherwise, it's not like, I know people think it's weird now. I see people writing things about me like, they're like, well, he's an insider. You know, he's a real insider. Like, yes, I'm an insider. You know, like, you know, they asked Willie Sutton, why did you rob banks? That's where the money is. Like, I was getting a job. You know, I wanted to be on TV. I wanted to be a reporter. I wanted to earn a living. So, yeah, no, I, of course, if I could get on the inside, I'm going to get on the inside. But that's why I'm here, like, as a plant. I can bring people like you in because I have a separate skill set. But they never looked and said, I mean, I'm sure they looked and said, well, we like Brian Kenny because he is thinking, well, you know, on his feet on the set. But it wasn't because we love his sabermetric values.
Yeah.
That was just something on the side. And even at the baseball network, I think they just liked my baseball sensibility, my love of the history and all of that. And I had a different way of thinking. So they did have that sort of in mind, but without the ability to also anchor and host shows for hours and hours, you know, of course, there's no chance I would be there.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see over the next several years as the current crop of very statistically savvy players graduates and retires and looks for jobs in broadcasting. And, you know, one of them is on this episode later in the second segment, Cole Figueroa. And we've seen a couple guys like that, Gabe Kapler and Brian Bannister, sort of briefly dabbled in broadcasting before they got snapped up by teams. But it'll be interesting to see if some of those guys do hang around and become broadcasters, then, you know, I don't know whether it would be the perfect foil for you or diffuse the tension that creates conflict that makes it interesting for viewers or what, but it'll be a different dynamic, at least one way or the other.
It's funny, my son and I, again, traveling around to do research for the book, we went to Fenway Park and watched a game with Bill James or went up to Cooperstown just to do some research. And he said, what would be left if everybody on TV was just smart? And at first we laughed, where's the tension? Where's this? And it was like, nah, it'd be a smart conversation. Mm-hmm. It would be glorious. Uh-huh. It would be good. It was like, how often have I had you on the air or like Dave Cameron where I've just attacked?
Right.
I can disagree with you, but it's all within certain shades of things. No, that would be good. And by the way, I've had Gabe Kapler before he went with the Dodgers on the air. He's super hardcore, super strident. Mm-hmm. I love that because I was even being mealy-mouthed about, I can see maybe bunting. And he's like, no, he's yelling at me. And I was like, yeah, no, you're right. I needed a slap in the face. I'm starting to acquiesce and go, everybody is saying it. So why am I being that guy? I shouldn't be such a jerk, blah, blah, blah. And then Gabe Kapler was going double jerk on me. I was like, no, of course you're right. You go, Gabe. Yeah, no, you're right. And I love that. So, yeah, I like guys who come out with, more extreme positions saying, no, stick to this. But again, realize my position where I can I give you a quick example?
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought about this when you're asking another question. And it was, I think I tweeted out something on a guy's ERA, and it was like, hey, this guy is blah, 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 an ERA. And suddenly I got not an avalanche, but a whole bunch of shots on ERA. Oh, please. Oh, for a sabermetric thinker, please. And I'm thinking, okay, I get it. But I have other guys on the other side, who are still crowing about wins and losses. So I asked on Twitter, I said, hey, how about you two extremist factions fight it out and I'll fight the winner? Because I can go either way. I get it that there's a lot of noise in ERA. I understand it. And yet, come on, it is basic run prevention. I know it's not strictly to them. I know there's more sophisticated ways of analyzing it, but you're going to get to a place where people do just glaze over at your writing, and that's being done now in a lot of different websites, that it gets so sophisticated that you're not relating this to a fan. And but I crack up when I see, wow, I cited ERA or FIP, or I cited XFIP, and oh God, how could you possibly do that? I'm like, wait, 90% of the baseball population is still not getting that. I'm just trying, can we go from wins and losses to ERA? And then if you want to say, I never use ERA, there's so many more sophisticated ways. Yeah, no, man, do it. Of course. But it's amazing to me to see these two, these two ways of thinking still coexist. And they're both on the far extremes.
Mm-hmm. And just very briefly, because you brought it up at the beginning of this conversation, the Hall of Fame and how that was kind of your gateway to stats in some sense, you mentioned this idea in your book that ball players react to incentives. And if batting average was the big incentive at a certain point of someone's career, then maybe they went for batting average. Maybe if on base percentage had been the dominant prized stat that players got paid for at the time, maybe they would have been a different player. So do you take that kind of thing into account when you are evaluating someone's Hall of Fame case? Or do you just say, we have to judge them based on what we know now, but we can't imagine a hypothetical world where, they're a different type of player because people pay more for different sorts of stats?
That's interesting. I like the way you put that, because actually you just convinced me while you're asking me the question. You should judge someone. You can agree or disagree with me on this. I think you should judge someone on what they did in their time and place, right?
Yeah.
I think on the by and large, you do that. And if you wanted to look at Steve Garvey, and I had these conversations with Max Kellerman years ago, Steve Garvey, was playing in a time where batting average and RBIs were it. And what did he do? He got his batting average. He got his RBIs.
Right.
So he has every right, Steve Garvey, and I saw him at the All-Star game, and he has every right to turn around and go, hey, whoa, what gives? This is what you people wanted. I gave it to you. And now I'm not a Hall of Famer. I didn't walk a lot. And I'll give you a quick example, too. I think this got cut from the book because I had to cut 100 pages. I mean, I don't know if you and Sam did this, but I had to cut 100 pages from my book because I just went down many, many a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And I brought up the Brandon Phillips, Trent Rosecrantz, Rosecrantz beef last year. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where Trent was for the Cincinnati Inquirer was tweeting out about the low on base percentage for Brandon Phillips. And Brandon blew up at him, cursed him out. And then he went, right after all that brouhaha, which was pretty ugly, he then went on the road, and I think he walked more in the next series in Colorado in the next 2 days than he had in the previous month. like three times. Uh-huh. But he works walks, and he said something. He had this quote afterwards because one person thought enough to say, hey, you threw two walks today. It's been a while since you did that. And he goes, and he had something to the effect of, hey, if that's what y'all want, like, I'll do it.
Right.
You know, and it's a fascinating study of incentives.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, if that's what you all want, fine, I'll do it. I don't think there's any question that, like, in a different era, you know, Rod Carew and George Brett even would probably be just, you know, swinging uppercut for the fences right now. It's the time and place.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I one last thing on that. I said this at the Hall of Fame. I was walking through the Hall of Fame on a recent trip, and I just see the plaque of Rabbit Moranville,
uh-huh.
right? You know, Rabbit Moranville, shortstop in the old days, who is basically seen as, like, one of the worst Hall of Famers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because he hit 258 and with no power, et cetera. And he's seen and anytime anybody brings up, like, Hall of Fame cases, they go, hey, they put this guy in. Come on. I mean, you can put, you know, whoever your case is now, put him in, because Rabbit Moranville. And I'm looking at Rabbit Moranville's plaque. I just happened to, like, stop right in front of it. And it said, I think it said most games played at shortstop, like, second in at-bats all time in the National League.
Uh-huh.
You know, at the time he retired, he played the most games at shortstop and the second most plate appearances ever in the National League. And then it said, member of 1914 Boston Braves miracle team, won World Series.
Uh-huh.
I hope I'm getting it near correct. And I looked at that, just reading that and thinking, hey, if it's 1953 or 1954, that's a Hall of Famer.
Right.
Like, you know, you can overthink it. I mean, I definitely overthink it. You overthink it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put yourself in the 1950s and say, all right, here's a shortstop, and Rabbit Moranville was seen as an excellent fielding shortstop. This was in a day where, you know, they barely have gloves. So you can imagine how even more important a good fielding shortstop is. The guy played for 20-something years. He had the most at-bats, most games played at his position ever, and led a team to a World Series championship. Is that a Hall of Famer? Yes.
Yeah.
That's a Hall of Famer. Like, and I don't have to know his on base. I don't have to know his weighted runs created plus. I don't have to look at his 8-year, 10-year, 12-year peak. I don't have to go back. I'll never know his range factor. Like, I'll never know his UZR or his defensive run saved. But you know what? Good enough. That's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. My column at Baseball Prospectus used to be called Overthinking It, because I was guilty of that from time to time. And anyway, it's an interesting question, and I wonder about it a lot, because there are certain players who might have been able to morph into different players if they had known that it was more valuable, or if people had stressed that. On the other hand, there are players who I think are just the type of player they are in any era. It wouldn't matter. They couldn't do anything differently than the way they did it. So I do kind of default to just judging them based on today's standards, even if in some cases that might be a little unfair.
Well, look at Andre Dawson,
right,
too.
Yes.
Just a quick thing on, like, the one thing he didn't do was walk.
Uh-huh.
The one thing. If he was in an on-base percentage era, would he have walked? I think he would have. I don't think he would have said, no, this is the way I have to do it. No, you can make some adjustments to your zone. So, yeah, I that was a real tough case for me for Hall of Fame, because by my normal standards, my personal criteria, he doesn't make it. But hey, what am I really doing here? Like, let me properly judge the guy. And if you told me this guy can run, hit for power, you know, just be an all-around great player, the one thing he doesn't do is walk.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a great player? Yeah, that can be a great player.
Right. All right. Very last thing. We can keep this short. Baseball and boxing, your two sports loves. I don't know whether anything ties your fandom of the two together, whether there's anything you value in each of them that's kind of a common strain between them. But I know that, you know, the way they get talked about in the culture is often in a baseball is dying, boxing is dying. And of course, people have been saying these things for a century, for more. Brian Curtis wrote something for Grantland about how people have been saying baseball is dying since basically the beginning of baseball. But of course, if you know, compare the popularity, the American mind share, however you want to judge it, of baseball or boxing, you know, 70 years ago to today, obviously it's a smaller percentage of people's attention. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Did you have any hesitation when it came to hitching your wagon to two things that people constantly are predicting the demise of? And then I just want you to give me a score. How would you score your lifetime head-to-head bout against Floyd Mayweather in the various interviews in which you two have squared off?
Well, you know, first of all, like, I also love thoroughbred racing. You want to throw that in there?
Sure.
That would be the other one, like, the, you know, the other 1940s big sport.
Right.
I just, again, my time and place was coming up in, you know, growing up in the 1970s and then coming of age in the 80s when boxing was still very, very big. And I arrived in the Hudson Valley and went to the Catskill Boxing Club, the Customato Catskill Boxing Club, when I was 22 years old. And Mike Tyson was training there. And so I'm still, you know, a young guy. I started training there. So I started training alongside Mike Tyson when he was a teenager on the way up. Saw him, you know, win the heavyweight title, you know, from his living room with Camille Ewald. So that was, it wasn't that I want to cling to boxing. It was like, no, this was presented right in front of me. And it was excellent. So I lived through that time. And then start, you know, because I had this expertise in boxing between that boxing club and then Floyd Patterson was also there. He had a boxing club in New Paltz, New York, and was training his son, Tracy Patterson, to world championships. There was just a lot of boxing going on in my world. And so when I got to ESPN, I remember telling Norby Williamson, who still runs things up there, hey, by the way, I really know boxing. And they were like, oh, okay. So they gave me auditions for Friday Night Fights, and I auditioned Teddy Atlas and Max Kellerman, mm-hmm. Among others. And right away we started doing, you know, a couple of months later, Friday Night Fights. So yeah, I just had that in my background. And I guess to get to the question itself, yeah, I've seen it definitely be, you know, become much more of a niche sport, but nobody's in charge of boxing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the Wild West. It's barnstorming. Yeah, there's nobody looking out for its long-term health. That's very different in baseball. While also keeping an eye on, and I'm sure they think of this in the league office, because between Rob Manfred and Tony Petitti, they're responsive to what's happening in the marketplace. They're not up there in the ivory tower thinking that, oh, everything is just great and it always will be. You have to remember, you know, nobody says that everybody has to love baseball and football and basketball. Nobody says that. It doesn't have to be. And hockey.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be that way. I always refer to, there was a Sports Illustrated cover, I think in 1980, that said, is football dying?
Yeah, right.
Is football dying? And now all I've heard the last 10 years is that football is king. Football is everything.
Although now I guess the is football dying is kind of coming back into vogue for different
back.
Reasons.
Yes. But, yeah, and actually I think that's a much more significant reason.
Yeah.
I think that's like, can you, and this is the same thing in boxing. Like, how big can it be when you won't let your kids do it?
Uh-huh.
You know, how big can it? And so that's what I think, that's what the commissioner has rightly focused on with baseball, that we've got to get kids playing baseball. Like this conversation started, you asked about, you know, how did you get into baseball? How did I get into baseball? What do you mean? That's not even a question for someone my
yeah.
age. Baseball was it, man. You know, and yeah, there was football, there's basketball. Of course, you dug that too. But no, baseball was it. So you need people playing it. And that is, by the way, a real problem going forward for football. So in the short term, and if this is a short term for 20, 30 years, I think we're going to see quite a reversal at the top between baseball and football. Again, I think baseball still overtakes football. Now, in the larger sense, like keep backing up, you definitely have to look at everything and say, are we still going to love these institutionalized sports? Nothing says we have to, you know, nothing says that everyone just won't be bungee jumping and skiing. I don't know. You don't have to love this stuff. So you always have to be mindful of your consumer, mindful of your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a Floyd Mayweather question in there, right?
Well, do you consider him undefeated, or would you say that you were his only adversary that triumphed?
Well, I don't grade it that way. I don't score the fights that way.
Uh-huh.
I just look at it that was also an extension of me with a real BS detector.
Uh-huh.
That it started with Floyd. Well, you know, I won't bore you with the details, but it was about who's the real world champ and blah, blah,
right.
blah.
And yeah, the videos are on YouTube.
And he was passing off his nonsense, or that, oh, I'll fight this guy anytime I want Pacquiao. And it's like, well, no, that's not what's happening. But in the boxing world, remember, no one in the mainstream media really called these guys on anything because they didn't follow it. So any fighter could come off on any show, you know, anywhere, and just spout off about how everybody else was a coward and you were the real champ and the greatest ever, blah, blah, blah. And again, the TV guy or girl would be there and just say, oh, okay, thanks for being with us.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a second. Last week I had Vernon Forrest on this show. Last week I had Shane Mosley on this show. He said this about you. Like, I was in the world going, wait a second. And so Floyd, like, would turn around and go, well, where's this coming from? But he enjoyed a lot of that. Like, and there was a time where he didn't enjoy it, but there was a time where he enjoyed that verbal sparring. and us going back and forth, which I did as well. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to show you. You know, the best interviews and the one classic interview that lives to this day on YouTube and has all these, you know, millions of viewers. In that one, I remember going into it and I was not loaded for bear. Yeah, I got in my shots here and there, but I was really just asking questions. And I was just, and that was actually, that was in the book too, and I had to cut it out. That also got edited out. I had a whole dissertation on the interview and why it resonated. And basically it resonated because I really was asking fair questions. If I was unfair, if I was just rude to him, it wouldn't have been the same watch. But it was just a fascinating case of me staying neutral, asking questions, and yes, hot-shotting here, hot-shotting from the outside here and there.
Yeah.
I do. That's my combative nature. But he's the same way. He's flailing at me.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it comes out is that, yeah, it was me calling nonsense and him, like most all of us, acting in his own short-term self-interest.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is what happens when you don't have to break for commercial. I guess you end up talking much longer than you had planned. We could have fit an entire MLB Now episode into this podcast. But thank you for sticking with me. Everyone can watch Brian on MLB Network just about every day. You can find him on Twitter at Mr. Brian Kenny, where he will very likely respond to you if you tweet at him. And you can buy his book, or at least the part that's left after the 100 pages he had to cut. It's called Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution. You can get it in all the usual places. Brian, thank you very much.
All right, Ben, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, before we bring in Cole Figueroa, let's pause for a minute to talk about our sponsor, SeatGeek. Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process for a long time. It's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show you want to go to, and none of those older ticket sites wants to change that. But SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. SeatGeek is always the first place I would recommend going to look for tickets to a game or concert. I've gone elsewhere in the past. I've overpaid. I've been scammed. I've been burned. Just go to SeatGeek, save yourself some money, save yourself some heartache. Everything about SeatGeek is designed to make life easier for sports and music fans. With SeatGeek, you'll never need to waste time checking prices on other ticket sites. SeatGeek does that for you by pulling all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and never miss a deal. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Best of all, Ringer MLB Show listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get that $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, and then enter that promo code, which is RingerMLB. SeatGeek will then send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code RingerMLB today. All right, so we are back with Cole Figueroa, who just got back himself from a game for the New Orleans Zephyrs, the AAA affiliate of the Miami Marlins, and he's now talking to me late at night in his hotel room. And the last time I had Cole on a podcast was in March, and there had been a bunch of articles written about how he was a big stat head, and he liked to do analysis, and he liked to code, and so all the nerds like me got excited and thought, oh, he's just like us, except much more athletic. And we all wanted to talk to you and have you on our podcast. So that happened. And that was late March. You were fighting for a job with the Pittsburgh Pirates and you ended up winning that job. And I wish I could say that you played happily ever after for the Pirates and that was the way the story ended. But unfortunately not. The story has taken a couple of twists and turns since then. So first of all, hello. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, here we are at the Sheridan. So much for the happily ever after.
Yeah. So do major league teams never stay in Sheratons?
No, it's not on the usual itinerary list.
Okay, well, still, AAA is Sheraton. I imagine at lower levels, it's considerably worse than Sheraton.
Oh, so sure. I've stayed at plenty worse.
Yeah. So I have to talk to you about your time with the Pirates. So you spent a good deal of time with them, and you were in this role, which, you know, you knew you were in for, and you had essentially tried out for this role where you'd be a utility man and a defensive replacement, and you'd be coming in and playing different positions and not knowing exactly when you were going to get into games. And, you know, that's the position that was available to you, and I'm sure you were happy to have it. But it must have presented some serious challenges because, I mean, just looking at the stat line, 23 games, 27 plate appearances, that's not the ratio that anyone really wants. And so, you know, I think you started a couple games, you played one full game on a day that there were two games that the Pirates played. But
just right. having that sort of sporadic action had to be difficult, even though you knew it was sort of what you signed up for going in.
Sure. So I guess I'll start from the genesis. So last time we spoke, we were about, about 2 weeks out from spring training being dispersed into the cities. We actually had a scrimmage game, I guess one of those fan-based games in Indianapolis where we were playing the Reds. And actually, to that point, I had no idea what was going on. The other two guys that were competing for the spot had no idea what was going on. We had all three shipped our cars to Pittsburgh, hoping that we were the one guy that got the roster spot. And prior to the game, there was an announcement that was made that the roster spot had been filled, but they weren't going to let us know until post-game in case of injuries. So really, I didn't actually know I was going to make the team until 30 minutes before we got on the flight to Pittsburgh. So it was one of those, like, climactic phone calls that I either had to make to my wife, and I think she was going to cry either which way. She was I'm either going to tell her we're going to be back in AAA for another year, or at least for the time being, or we're going to Pittsburgh and I'll get to, you know, play in the big leagues for a little bit of time. Obviously, that's how it worked out. So I made the team. You know, everything was great. I get there. Obviously, as a utility role, you know that at-bats are going to be sporadic. I had been a utility role player for Tampa. I had a little time with the Yankees, not too much. Both for the 2 days, I had two starts, so I guess that wouldn't really be considered a utility role. But I knew kind of what the territory brought. What I wasn't expecting was a team that was going to catch absolute fire, the Pirates, that first month. They were just unstoppable. Everyone was clicking on all cylinders. I think Clint was just riding the wave out, and basically there were just no at-bats to be had. And my first at-bat came actually, I would say, probably about a week into the season. So I went 7-day period without any at-bats. I got a pinch hit at-bat, and then I eventually got 8 more pinch hit at-bats over the course of a month. So as you can figure out, you know, roughly every 6 days, 5 to 6 days, I'm getting an at-bat. I went 0-for-9. The team was doing well, but then we had a bullpen blowout day when we went to San Diego. And when trying to give you a little background, when you're the 25th guy, anytime you have bullpen blowout days in terms of the bullpen gets used extensively for either one full day or for a couple full days, you're always going to be the odd man out. So like for myself, knowing the game and knowing how it worked and kind of knowing the interminglings in the front office, I knew it was kind of an end to my first stint in the big leagues when we had that big blowout day in San Diego, and I got sent down the next day. When you go down, it's pretty much an easy transfer the first time. You know, you hope to go back up. I was still on the roster at the time. You hope to be quick, and I was actually down for about 3 weeks. So it wasn't too long of a time before I got my next call up. When I had a talk with Clint, when I got back up there, he's like, we're going to get you a little bit more playing time this time. I know last time wasn't really how you thought it was going to be. And actually, the whole defensive replacement thing really didn't hold true as well, because our defensive metrics were really good and he was just, you know, playing the guys that were rolling. I mean, I don't blame him, obviously, for playing the guys who were doing well. I mean, that just makes sense, right? You play the players that are doing well, and if you're winning, well, you keep playing those players. But in the spin side to that, when you're a utility guy and you're not getting those regular pinch hit at bats or those regular spot starts, that's when the struggles come. You start second guessing yourself as a player. Defensively, I played in 3 innings, I think it was, before the first time I got sent down, so I really wasn't being used off the bench that much as a defensive replacement. So when I got back up the second time, I was hoping, you know, things were going to change a little bit. And they did. I think it ended up being 16 or 17 at-bats the next month. I was up for another month, so 16, 17 at-bats over the month. So I was roughly, you know, getting an at-bat, you know, every other day, sort of. But I had 2 spot starts, one against Yu Darvish when he came back, and then one against Jacob deGrom on the doubleheader day, and those were my 2 spot starts. So you can see the bench life. Even when you do get starts, typically it's to give guys a breath when you're facing an ace. So it wasn't made for success, but when you're in that role, you kind of know what's going on. So I know that my allowment of at-bats, even though it's small and maybe it's extensively against guys who are really good, I know that's my job, and I just didn't perform to the level they were expecting. And I you know, I totally understand how things shook out. So I wasn't too hurt by that.
Yeah, and I mean, at the same time, it's got to be really tough because you look at the slash line and it's not great, and
right.
you probably feel bad about that. But at the same time, it's 26 at-bats in your entire time with the Pirates. And, you know, you're someone who knows about sample sizes and
right.
when things become reliable. And we talked about that when you were in spring training, and your whole future at that point depended on what you were doing in that little span of a few weeks there. And, you know that that might not be all that predictive, you know, whether
sure.
it's really a great 3 weeks or a terrible 3 weeks. It might not mean all that much about what you're going to do in
right.
the future. But your job still hinges on it. And with the Pirates, it was even more so. I mean, you're getting, you know, a few at-bats a week, and that doesn't really tell you all that much about who you are as a hitter, especially coming under the conditions you just described. And yet, at the same time, you know, mentally, if your one at-bat in the last few days went poorly, then you're probably just dwelling on that the entire time.
Correct. The human element definitely plays a part in those at-bats, because you do lose that confidence, that edge that you had, or at least I had in spring training. Even though the sample size in spring training was small, it was over a shorter period of time, so there were more consistent at-bats. And then when I obviously got to the big league level, now these at-bats actually mean something. So when you don't produce, you know, they're going to find someone who will. Now, if someone goes in there and hits 350, does that mean they're a 350 hitter? Like we were speaking, the sample size is so small. Probably not. But that's just how it is. I mean, the utility, the 25th man, the bench spot, it's such a revolving door. And that's why you see a lot of the same guys with different teams, because, you know, they're hoping to strike lightning in a bottle for 1 year.
Yeah, is it harder to come off the bench and hit, or come off the bench and play in the field? Because I know there's been research, which you're probably aware of, about
yeah.
the pinch hit penalty, and it seems that when guys pinch hit, they actually hit worse than they do when they are not pinch hitting, even if you account for the quality of the pitchers or whatever. It just
right.
seems that guys don't perform as well in that role, and you'd figure it's because they're not warmed up the way they usually are. They haven't been seeing pitchers all day, whatever it is. Is it equally hard to come in and read the ball off the bat and get a good jump and that sort of thing?
No, I actually think, at least from my perspective, I think that if you're sound defensively, it's an easier skill to hone.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a success-based skill. Fielders who, you know, obviously they're fielding in the 95th percentile on average. So it's something that you're going in very confident in. In terms of hitting, obviously, the production can be a little more limited. It's definitely when you're facing someone who is a very good pitcher, you're already at the mercy of that. Even if I had a full day's work, when you're facing a pitcher who's an elite pitcher, it's you're still in the red probably.
Mm-hmm. And was there anything you could do either physically or psychologically to cope with this role? You know, every now and then you'll hear some old veteran who's, you know, now a specialized pinch hitter or maybe a DH or something
right.
talk about how, oh, you know, when I was younger, I didn't know how to handle this. And now I know how to prepare myself and I know how to warm up, or, you know, it's different in some way from what I did before.
I don't know the research behind pinch hitting, but I don't think anyone has the special sauce. Like,
yeah,
I really believe that 1 year a pinch hitter can be really good and then the next it could be really bad. I just
yeah.
think the sample size is too small to evaluate like these guys are just pinch hit extraordinaires. Everyone has a different extent of what they do in the cage or warm up. Sure, I mean, it's easy hindsight to say I would do things differently, but I really don't think so. I mean, I think I did as much as I could. It wasn't like it was a lack of work. I definitely worked hard. Just the results weren't there, and that's just it's a results-based game, and sometimes, you know, you'll be on the chopping block even if you feel like the sample size wasn't warranted.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you ultimately get the news that you were?
Right. So I'm in Indianapolis for the second tour. We had just had a game. At this point, I'm doing really well in Indianapolis. I play really well. Every time I get sent down, I get regular bats. I'm doing really well. So I wasn't really expecting too much, but the team at the big league level was performing very poorly at the time. So
mm-hmm.
you, as a guy who's been around a little while, you start to know when the team performs poorly, especially a small market team, they're going to tend to give guys, especially younger guys, a little more of a shot to show if they can stick long term. And I think that's at that point when they started to get, I think it was 15 or 16 games behind the Cubs, that's when they made the decision that they needed to bring in fresh bodies to see what they could bring to the team. And it actually ended up working out. They brought up a young guy, Adam Frazier, really good hitter, and he's playing the bench role right now. He's getting a little more regular playing time, but he's deserved it because he's come off the bench and done really well. And then they've also reinvigorated the pitching staff with a lot of their young arms. So I definitely see the direction they went in there, but I did know that the beginning to the end was coming once the team started to scuffle. So when I got that phone call, I was actually in Indianapolis. We had got back from a road trip. I get designated. I know the routine. I know the whole designation process because I've been through it a couple times prior. I know that, you know, there is a window for trading, and then they're going to try to send me through waivers. Neil Huntington, the GM, said, we're going to try to trade you first out of respect for you. I think we had a good working relationship, and if nothing comes up, we're going to send you through waivers and see if anyone claims you there. So that's what they did. They called me back 3 days later saying that there was no team willing to trade, so they put me through the waiver process, and I actually ended up getting claimed by the Dodgers at that point. So yeah. The story continues, and right. Thus starts my whirlwind of a summer.
Yeah, and so this is your first in-season move, right? Because the Pirates were your fourth organization. You were drafted by the Padres, you went to the Rays, you went to the Yankees, but those were off-season moves, and so this was your first in-season move. So what challenges come with that as far as just, you right. know, where you're going to go? And
so the first thing you have to do is figure out transportation. I had been optioned down to AAA. I got a call from Gabe Kapler. He's the farm director there. He's like, hey, we are optioning to AAA. They're actually playing in Nashville. So if you'd like, I had my car at the time that I didn't know what to do with. So I told him, like, listen, I will drive to Nashville. And then if you guys give me a couple days, I'll get out to Oklahoma City after that. I just need time to move. Now, not only do I have my car to worry about, we have an apartment in Pittsburgh that we need to keep or get rid of. Obviously, we're not going to be in Pittsburgh anymore, right. So we have to go through the whole process. And generally, teams do a good job of making sure you're repaid for the rent that you – or reimbursed for the rent you are paying that month. So we get that squared away. We're literally in the place in Pittsburgh for those seven-day window I was talking about, where I'm just kind of sitting around waiting to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And at this point, my wife's out there throwing me soft toss. We have like a little t-ball field behind our apartment in Pittsburgh, and she's literally like throwing the ball kind of from a side angle, and I'm hitting it into a metal chain link fence. And then I'm throwing the ball. We have only two baseballs. So I'm literally throwing the ball. I'm throwing it as long as I can. I'm stepping back as far as I can. I'm throwing it about 180 feet as hard as I can, just so I can keep in baseball shape for the next team or the next move. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of the funny things that sometimes people don't hear about, is that you need to stay in shape for those 7 days, because if you do not, if you do end up getting claimed or picked up, the other team, you want to make a good first impression.
Right. Yeah, and you can't keep using your old team's facilities, I guess, and you can't do the new one because you don't know where you're going yet, so you're sort of stuck in between.
Exactly. There's rules in place that say you're not allowed, because if you get injured, it's an automatic release. So I'm outside of this Little League T-ball park. I can only imagine what these people are thinking, that,
hey,
this,
that
my poor wife. Well, my poor wife's throwing this baseball, and they're just like, I mean, sometimes we'd have people come by and they'd see her throw it and then run out of the way, and I would swing, and the swings wouldn't be really that great because, you know, I didn't want to hit her just in case I misswung, or, you know, I was just trying to keep my body in check.
Uh-huh.
So eventually we get out of Pittsburgh, we get out all of our stuff, we drive to Nashville, we have myself, my wife, and our dog in the car, packed with everything we own from Pittsburgh, which is a bunch of stuff, and we get to Nashville. And we meet up with the team. And obviously, when you go to a different team in season, it's kind of awkward. First, you have to meet people on a personal level. And then it's one of those things where you have to show them your skills, not only the front office, but your teammates. I mean, they're like, wow, we just picked up another infielder. I mean, can this guy really play? And that's the first thing they think. So you have to go out there and try to impress your coaches that you're playing for now, your teammates in the front office. So that's definitely another obstacle that brings in the human element, because you put this added pressure on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I got off to a good start. I do really well. I'm playing really well for about a week. My wife and I are, you know, talking about how good things are. And we get back to OKC. We play a couple of days, and we move into our second apartment. Literally, I kid you not, 30 minutes later, I get a phone call saying that I need to come to the field. So I get to the field. I already know in the back of my mind something's happening. And typically when they tell you to come to the field, you're either going up or you're getting designated. And I was pretty sure I wasn't going up because the night before they had called up another guy. Uh-huh. So I was like, oh gosh, here we go. So I get to the field and I see my name's in the lineup. So I'm like, oh, so that's good. So it's obviously I'm not getting designated. So I get my stuff on, I start warming up, and then my manager finds me. He's like, I need to talk to you. I was like, okay. And he tells me I've been designated again. And I'm like, wow. So this one kind of came out of nowhere because I was playing well.
Did he not know that when he was filling out the lineup card?
Exactly. I'm in the lineup. So it's just funny how teams will go about hiding the fact they're making a move,
yeah,
or try to do things just in case. And I understand why, because if there was an injury with me warming up or something happened to another player while the guy was traveling, you just never know. Mm-hmm. So it's like this secret message that just never gets across until they lay the gauntlet down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, speaking of tiny sample sizes, I mean, you were with the Dodgers for 6 games, 23 plate appearances, which is, you know, right, almost as many as you had with the Pirates at the big league level. And you did as mm-hmm. well as anyone could do in 23 plate appearances. You hit 316, you had a over 400 on base. So, I mean, what was it that...
It was just a move that they had to make because, I mean, when you think about logistics of a team, and you can't always think about it on a personal level. It's not personal. It's everything is done for the betterment of the team. There was a need. They needed an outfielder, preferably left-handed hitting, so they called up Andrew Tolles. They needed a roster spot. So typically what teams do, at least from my understanding, is they go down the list and they figure out who they think is going to be least likely to get picked up or claimed. And that's just solely how they do it. And me being kind of a journey guy at that point, I think that's what they thought. You know, if we can keep Cole, great. We'd like to keep him in the system, but we think that he would be the guy that would be least likely to get claimed. And they were right. I didn't get claimed, but the story continues from there. And, you know, the whirlwind of the summer keeps going. But I think the worst part about that is that we had just gotten to the apartment. We had just put down the down payment, the deposit, and it was just such, I mean, I can't tell you, like, when I had to make that phone call to my wife, I was just, like, dreading it because she had been a trooper thus far, but it definitely starts wearing on the stress levels when, you know, you're constantly moving, and now financially, you know, you've put down X amount of dollars for a new place, and to recoup it, it's going to take a while.
Yeah. And so I was going to ask if it's, does it make it easier or harder that she's with you throughout this? Because, you know, an older player might have a wife who's with the kids, has her own job, she's at home, so she's not with you anyway. She's, you know, finding out about all of this by phone. And your wife is kind of, you know, when you're moving, she's moving. So does that right. make it harder because you have to make her move, or easier because at least you're not alone?
It definitely, in some senses, both. But, I mean, she has an off-season job. She has a PhD. So her getting a job, she's a physical therapist, and they're very high-demand jobs. So she has no trouble finding work. So during the season, she typically travels with me because it makes it easier. When you have to travel, there are just little things you don't think about, mailing things home, getting mail back from our home. Her parents are close to our house, so it just makes things a lot easier when not everything is put on me to pay the bills and all the other aspects of just living during the season.
Okay, so as you sort of foreshadowed there, you did not end up staying with the Dodgers. So what led to the third move of the season?
Yeah, so the last act of the season, and that's kind of where we're at right now, is I get to have another 7-day window where I'm not playing baseball again. And it's so strange as a baseball player when baseball's going on and you're not playing, yeah, and you feel as if you should be playing. And this year, I don't even know exactly how many at-bats I've had, but it's got to be under 150. And I don't think I've ever had a year like that before. Mm-hmm. Because to hone your skills in, not only do you need consistent at-bats, you need a certain quantity of at-bats. So at this point, I'm sitting at home. The All-Star break comes 4 days after I get designated. I go through the whole All-Star break. At this time, we're talking to teams. I've declined my assignment for the Dodgers because I felt as if I would have a lot of interest out there, and I did. And then I end up signing a big league deal with the Marlins probably a day after the All-Star break, and they told me that they were going to option me to AAA again. I said, great. I'll meet the team in New Orleans because they had a 7-game homestand, and I took off from Tampa because we had went home after Oklahoma City. We just drove all the way home. So now we've gone from Tampa to Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh to Nashville, Nashville to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma City back to Tampa, Tampa to New Orleans. And that's that was our destinations and stops.
Yeah, sounds like a fun all-star break. So, I mean, it must be frustrating because, you know, like the more this happens, the greater the disadvantage it puts you in because you are missing time and then you have to take time to meet all these new people and, you know, impress all of these new people. And so you're kind of, you know, behind the eight ball each time it happens, which, you know, must just compound the frustration.
Sure. And I don't want anyone to believe that it's a poor me situation, because I think a lot of guys would sacrifice being on rosters for the travel that I've gone through. But there is an understanding that there is an element to it that when you have family, when you have all this travel, when you have so many different places you've lived, that it does take a toll on people. And it definitely took a toll on myself and my family. So, like I said, it's not that I want to cry poor me. I'm doing something that I love. I'm in a great situation. You know, obviously, when you're in AAA on a roster, you're very close to the big league. So I just wanted to throw that out there because it could be very easily misconstrued as like, you know, this guy's just complaining when he, in actuality, he's been on a roster all year.
Right. Yeah. And there are guys who've had it worse. You know, I can remember various guys who've just get stuck in waiver no man's land. Just, you know, they end up just not playing for a bunch of the season. They, you know, they're in four or five different teams in a single season. So could be worse. So
I could guess be worse. Yes. I guess, I mean, there's all, yeah. So it's half glass empty or half glass full, whichever way you want to look at it.
So why did you choose the Marlins when you did have a choice? Because you didn't have a choice to go to the Dodgers. They were the team that claimed you, but you picked the Marlins.
Right. So I think the big thing there was the big league offer. Being on the 40-man, knowing how important that was to being on a roster. I also had another team that was really close to giving me a roster spot, so Miami just reassured me that that would be there, and we told them that that would be our decision if they were willing to go that to that extent. Obviously, that was kind of short-lived as well. I played a couple of weeks in New Orleans, and then I was designated probably about a week or so ago, a week and a half ago, and now I'm playing in New Orleans, not on the roster, and just kind of going through the AAA schedule for the last month of the season. Mm-hmm.
So you were just kind of a casualty of the trade deadline, I guess. It was just another move that was made, and they needed a roster spot, and that's what happens.
And you go for your least likely. Like I said, it's you go down the list, and you're like, well, who's our least most likely to get picked up? And that's typically the guy that gets designated. That's usually how they make that decision.
Uh-huh. And so how does it work exactly? I assume you have an agent who just fields these offers. So, you know, the news comes across the wire that so-and-so was designated and or so-and-so was placed on waivers or whatever it was. And then you will just, you know, your agent will just hear from whichever teams are interested very quickly or?
Sure. So you typically have the period of waivers. The teams put in the claims or they do not put in the claims, and the team that designates you gives the callback once the waivers are executed, and they tell you basically if you've cleared or if you've been picked up. Now, if you've cleared, like I was the last time, they give you a 24-hour window to kind of talk it over with your agent to see if that's something you want to do, because when you get designated for the first time, you have to accept your assignment. But since this was my fourth or fifth time now, that you can reject the assignment. And so you have that power. So they give you that 24-hour window. And basically at this point of the season, with the at-bats I had, knowing that they did give me a roster spot late in the season and there could be opportunity later, I thought it was best served that I just, you know, stay in New Orleans and not try to venture it out again.
Mm-hmm. So you've now spent some amount of time with six different organizations over the course of your career. Is there a big difference day to day in just, you know, how the team handles its players, how it prepares its players for games? Or is it just purely down to your teammates or your manager and it doesn't really make much of a difference aside from that?
Well, I mean, some organizations have philosophies in terms of weight training, getting ready before the game. Some teams do like 30 minutes before the game, you need to be out, and they go through a team stretch. Typically, though, in my past experiences, typically the best way to do it, though, is when you're at this level, you want to make sure that when guys go up to the next level that they're not kind of lost. So you need to give them some guidance, but you also need to give them some room to kind of make their own mistakes and see what works for them and what doesn't. Because when they go up to the big leagues, no one's going to be there holding their hand saying, hey, this is how you have to do it. So as you progress through the system, they start, you know, drawing back on the rules, how you need to behave yourself, because it's just assumed that you're on a level that's one step from the big leagues and you should know how to go about your daily activities. And you also have older guys that can show you that way in AAA.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated by stories of players who will just be reinvented by one interaction with a coach. And, you know, maybe those are sort of simplified or overly dramatized stories, but, you know, you'll hear about like Rich Hill talks to Brian Bannister, you know, one time and suddenly Rich Hill is the best pitcher in the American League, or Zach Cozart went from being the worst hitter in the National League to a pretty good hitter after, you know, one conversation with Barry Larkin, who right. told him to swing harder and, you know, aim for the inside of the ball or something. And, you know, maybe things don't happen quite this way, but I wonder whether that is an advantage to at least getting to go to all these different organizations. You get exposed to a lot of different coaches and a lot of different philosophies about the game. And if there is one coach out there who can kind of unlock the best Cole Figueroa, you're increasing your odds of meeting him, I guess.
Sure. I mean, that plays both parts, because there's also a lot of noise out there as well. Uh-huh. There's a lot of coaches that I've seen that maybe do too much. And they can have very good hitters believe that they're doing things wrong and they end up struggling and you never hear about them again. I mean, I think those are the cases that are kind of interesting to me, are the guys that come out of high school or college and, you know, they do something a certain way and then they change when they get to pro ball and you never hear about them again. In terms of the one thing or one lesson from a coach, sure. I mean, there are definitely coaches that know what they're talking about. I do believe it's more on the confidence side of the human element. When you're confident, when you go in and someone tells you to do something and you start doing something that you haven't seen before, say, let's say the example you gave about Zach Cozart hitting the inside part of the baseball, he goes into BP and he starts hitting balls left and right. He starts hitting a couple homers in BP. Now the confidence level is really high. And really that's what the hitting coach is there for, is to build that confidence as well as mechanically change some swing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Are all ball players night owls? Is that just the way it has to be? Because you were telling me off air that you got a wake up call early this morning and it didn't actually wake you up because you were already awake and you didn't get back from your game until midnight. So, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely keep weird hours. Games get over really late. You definitely have that adrenaline rush post game. Guys have hard times falling asleep.
Yeah.
But in AAA, we take a lot of plane flights. We don't get to go charter, so we typically are on the same flight as, you know, every other person that's flying that morning. Mm-hmm. So when you're traveling in a big group like that, you have to get to the airport extra early to make sure all the equipment, all the players are there. Typically flights range from 5 in the morning to 7 in the morning. So typically the wake-up calls are around 3:40. And if you had a night game the day before, you're pretty much not getting any sleep or maybe a few hours at most.
Uh-huh. Okay, so are you renting a place in New Orleans, or have
no,
you given
no,
up?
I've given up hope on renting. Renting is, when I got to New Orleans, we were staying at an extended stay, uh-huh. and I said the whole lease situation this year has just turned me bitter to ever renting ever again.
All right. Well, I'm sorry that the season has taken the twist that it has, but at least you are playing baseball at a high level,
right.
And I hope that you'll have some consistency and you'll actually know where you're going to be playing and sleeping for the foreseeable future. So good luck, actually.
Thanks.
Sticking in one place and making the most of it. I hope it happens sometime soon.
No, thank you. And like I said, I'm happy with what's transpired. There's really nothing I would take back. The season has been a whirlwind, but it's definitely a learning experience.
All right. Well, good to talk to you as always.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So we will leave it there. Thank you to Brian and Cole. Enjoy your weekend. We'll be back with new episodes of the Ringer MLB Show next week.